The BU Prophet is always looking for contributors.
If you have a submission, whether it be a written article, a poem, a painting, a photograph, or even a song, then go to buprophet.com and hit the Submit Content button.
Your voice is valuable and important. Our only guidelines are BUSTH's community life policies and procedures. For more information, visit buprophet.com/submit.
Welcome to the BU Prophet podcast, the only official and probably the only Boston University School of Theology podcast.
If you're listening for the first time, then you're in the right place because this is the first ever episode. My name is Paige Holliday, and I am a second year MDiv student here at STH.
My name is John Ashley, and I am a second year MDiv student as well, and we will be your hosts. Why are we doing a podcast? Well, we wanted a place that we could continue the conversations that are started online on the Prophet blog, and we thought that the podcast was the platform to do that.
So the regular format will be a discussion with a contributor to the Prophet blog, which if you haven't yet visited, is at buprophet.com. We'll talk about the content of their submission and explore some of the questions that it raises.
For example, there's a statement on the front page of the Prophet website right now from the Students of Color Interest Group about the violence in Charlottesville. To discuss that, we'd invite some representatives from the Students of Color to join us as the experts and ask them to lead us deeper into the conversation that the statement is responding to.
We'll also have regular features including interviews with alumni and faculty, interactive opportunities like a March Madness bracket, and maybe even a competition or two.
But this episode is a little different. In fact, it's very special. 3 weeks ago, Boston University School of Theology installed Professor Kathy Dar as the Beck Chair of Hebrew Scripture.
Dr. Dar has been teaching at BU School of Theology for 3 decades, and last week we were lucky enough to secure an exclusive, feature-length interview with her.
BU Prophet Secretary Emily Ling spoke with Professor Dar about her new role, her life at and away from BU, and her love for binging Netflix series.
I am Emily Ling, a second year MDiv student, and today we are fortunate to interview Dr. Kathy Dar, Professor of Hebrew Bible here at STH. Dr. Dar is a winner of Boston University's prestigious Metcalf Award for Excellence in Teaching. She has authored 3 books, numerous essays and articles for scholarly journals, as well as educational materials for the United Methodist Publishing House. And part of why we wanted to have her as our first guest on the podcast was because she was also recently appointed to the Beck Chair of Hebrew Scripture, which is a highly significant accomplishment here at BU. So Dr. Dar, thank you so much for being with us today. So we'll get into talking about the Beck Chair some a little, but I wanted to open just by hearing a little bit about your background. I believe you grew up in Kentucky and came from a religious home. How early on did you feel like teaching the Hebrew Bible was what you wanted to do for your life's work?
Well, I don't know exactly when I decided I wanted to teach the Hebrew Bible, but I fell in love with the Hebrew Bible as a little girl. My mother's parents gave me a Bible story book when I was about 7 years of age. It's here in my office. I keep it with me all of the time. A big thick book that I used to read from at night before I went to bed. Not because I was so pious, but just because I thought it was fascinating. Yeah. So the first time I read all the way through the book, the section on the Old Testament and the section on the New Testament, when I finished the book, I went back and started at the beginning again. And this time I read through the Hebrew Bible section and then stopped and went back and read that again and again. And by the time I outgrew that book, I had read the Old Testament portion 11 times. Oh, wow. So I can't really explain why, but for some reason, the stories in the Hebrew Bible portion of the book fascinated me in a way that the others did not. And so this interest was implanted in me at a very early age, and it never really went away. Mm-hmm. When I went to college, I majored in English literature, but I took as many Hebrew Bible courses as I could. And I guess, really, it was the second semester of my senior year that I paused after one of those courses and said to my professor, I should have majored in Hebrew Bible. I love it so much. And he said to me, well, honey, he called everybody honey. And he said, well, honey, you really should have. I said, well, I've never felt called to ordain ministry. And he said to me something that no one had ever told me before, and that is, you don't have to be an ordained minister to be a biblical scholar. So before I left his class that afternoon, he had offered to drive me to Vanderbilt University, where he had done his doctoral program. It was in Nashville, and we were in Owensboro, Kentucky, so it wasn't that long a drive. And sure enough, he drove me to Vanderbilt. He introduced me to some of the faculty who were there. And that fall, I enrolled at Vanderbilt and began my study of the Hebrew Bible, now with an eye to being a professor of that field at some point.
Yeah. So then you did both your master's and PhD at Vanderbilt, right?
I did, yes.
So then how did you go from Nashville to Boston?
Well, I took a route through Ohio. While I was at Vanderbilt, I met and married my husband, John Darr, who is an associate professor of New Testament at Boston College, just down the road from here. And as we were working on our dissertations, we decided that we would like to interview for jobs. And we were offered a one-year position at Baldwin Wallace College in Berea, Ohio. It was for 1 year only because one of their regular faculty in biblical studies had received a grant that would allow him to take a year off from teaching to do his research and writing. So we went there to fill in for this gentleman. And it was during the spring semester of our year there that I was off teaching a class. When I came back, my husband said to me, James Bond called. And I looked at him sort of the way you just looked at me, Emily, and I said, what? And he said, yes. He said, Dr. Simon Parker, who's obviously British and teaches at Boston University School of Theology, called, and they want you to come and interview for a job there. So naturally, we were very excited.
Yeah.
And they brought me here for an interview. And then a short time later, they brought me back for a second interview, and then I received the offer to come here.
Awesome. So you've been teaching at Boston University for over 3 decades,
I believe. Yes, I came in 1983.
Okay. So you've witnessed a lot of the evolution of the school.
Yes.
What...
And of the university, too.
True, yeah.
That's right.
What strikes you as the most significant change at BU School of Theology from your first few years here until the present? I'm sure mm-hmm. there have been many, but kind of with that longer scope of history to look at, what's the most significant perhaps?
Well, there have been, as you say, many, many changes. Not all of them significant, but a number of them have been significant. And it's difficult for me off the top of my head to single out a few, but let me try. One of the things that has changed so much at the school is the leadership model that we have here. Our dean, Mary Elizabeth Moore, everybody knows her name, but I thought I'd say it anyway, brought with her 7+ years ago a leadership style that is much more egalitarian and that seeks earnestly to involve a wide range of voices. The seeds of that kind of greater openness and involvement were certainly in the process of being planted in the early 80s when I came, but we've come a long way since then. And so we are a more inclusive community. In many ways, not every way, but in many ways, a more respectful and open community. We still have our moments, but not as many as we used to have. And let's see. And I think that that our students just keep getting better. The students aren't exactly the same as students were in the early 80s, and they have challenges that students in the 80s didn't have, but the opposite is true as well. And I just find a much greater willingness on the part of administrators, faculty, staff, and students to express themselves as integral parts of this community and to bring their concerns forward so that we as a community can discuss them. I was at community lunch a little earlier this afternoon, and I heard the announcement about an upcoming town hall meeting. And I wondered if the students who joined us in September had a sense of how important those town hall meetings are. It's not the case that only a few students come. Instead, administrators come, faculty show up in significant numbers, students, staff, people from across the School of Theology attend these town hall meetings, and everyone's invited to bring forward their concerns, their interests, their celebrations, everything. We didn't have town hall meetings when I first got to the School of Theology, or for a very long time after I arrived. So those meetings are themselves testimony to how far the School of Theology has come.
Yeah, that's fantastic to have you note that, because I think I didn't really recognize the significance of those town halls when I first arrived. But even just being here a year and seeing the caliber of conversations and how important they are. Yeah, I've kind of registered, and it's, it makes me appreciative that I'm at school here now.
Absolutely.
Where our voices can be heard.
Absolutely. Yeah. And of course, the School of Theology doesn't operate in academic isolation. We're part of Boston University. And so I think any full answer I could give to your question, and I can't give a completely full answer, of course, but would have to take account of changes within Boston University as well. When I came here, the president of BU was John Silber, a very brilliant, opinionated, and controversial figure. And the School of Theology, like other schools and colleges in the university, had to negotiate Silber's ideas and goals for the university. And personally, I think John Silber did a lot for BU, but it wasn't always easy to negotiate his strongly held ideas. I'm saying this so nicely because I actually had a pleasant relationship with John Silber, and he was always very supportive of me. But there were also areas in which I disagreed with him strongly, and I suspect that a number of us old-timers who are still around would say the same thing. And I think the university has made significant improvements in important areas, including increasing the diversity of its faculty and staff and its student body. This was the issue, especially faculty diversity, since I was the chair of the faculty council. That was more my arena. We've made some real progress in that area, and that was a key issue for me during my 2 years. So it's terrific for me to realize the advances that the university has made in those areas of increasing the university's diversity. We still have a long way to go, but we're not standing still. Mm-hmm. We're moving forward. And credit for that in significant measure goes to Bob Brown and to the Board of Trustees of the university. The School of Theology is the leader among the schools and colleges of Boston University in this area. We're not the only school that's making progress. The law school has done a much better job of diversifying its faculty, the School of Social Work. There are other schools and colleges that have made real progress in this area. But the School of Theology is the leader on campus, both campuses, in terms of this effort. So I'm, and we should be.
We should be, we right. Should That's be. Encouraging
That's right.
to
we
hear.
We really should be, and we are. And we're recognized as such within the university as a whole.
That's so, fabulous, yeah. So 2 weeks ago, you were installed as the Harold F. Beck Chair of Hebrew Scripture.
Yes.
Which is only the third faculty chair at BU School of Theology.
That's right.
And it's the first chair in biblical studies.
Right.
And it apparently took over 30 years of work and the support of nearly 700 alumni and friends to officially raise the funding to create the chair.
That's right.
Can you share some with students not familiar with the process, what all is involved in creating a chair position?
Yes, you have to raise money.
Sounds like it.
Yeah, it's very simple. You have to raise money. And if we were a school of law, we would have many alums who make a great deal of money. If we were the medical school, we would have a great many alums who make lots of money. But School of Theology alums, by and large, get rich in spiritual things, but not in material things. And so for a School of Theology, to be able to endow chairs is a fantastic achievement. And it's not something that is accomplished easily. Harold Beck taught Hebrew Bible here for 33 years. He was an incredible preacher and teacher. I tried to convey that in my sermon 2 weeks ago. Many people who went to the School of Theology years ago still speak of the powerful influence Dr. Beck had in their lives. And so a number of these people decided years ago, Harold passed away 30 years ago. I remember when he died, I was already here when he passed. A number of people decided that they wanted to establish a chair in his honor and memory. Mm. And people have worked hard to do that. Many of them have given sacrificially to do that. It did take a long time, but that's not really surprising. And so the fact that the school was able to complete the funding for the Beck Chair is perhaps the main reason why 2 weeks ago was so joyful. Yeah. For all of us.
Yeah.
I think for my mother, the fact that I was installed as the Beck professor was equally joyous.
I'm sure.
And I was deeply appreciative of that as well. But the fact that the School of Theology and its alums were able to do this is cause for real celebration.
Yeah.
Real celebration.
In the sermon you gave in Marsh Chapel for the Beck installation, you talked about God offering shade or shadows to the weary.
Yes.
And you encouraged those in attendance to commit ourselves to casting shadows, small and ever expanding, of shalom
mm-hmm.
to all we meet.
Yes.
And I'm wondering, this is a two-part question.
Okay.
First, where are you currently finding spaces or practices that feel like shade to you when
yes.
you get weary?
Yes.
And then second, how are you either professionally or personally attempting to cast shadows for others that are protective or life-giving?
Okay. Well, in terms of where I find shade and shadows, Let me speak first as a biblical scholar, and second as a biblical scholar named Kathy Darr, who's also a person. Okay. So as a biblical scholar, I find shade and shadows in my community, my colleagues, and my students, and in my research and writing, in this sense, because I, you know, like I said, I'll get to the personal part in just a minute, but let me explain what I mean by that, because people who are listening to this might say, well, that's just what a professor would say, right? But let me explain it. I learned a long time ago when I was at Vanderbilt that if you're going to teach in a way that has some small chance of making a difference, you have to keep your own tank filled. You can't do that on an empty fuel tank. And for me, there's some ways in which having a PhD in Hebrew Bible means that you have a greater awareness of how little you know, mm-hmm. right? So you never feel like, oh, now I know this field. And so in order to keep myself fueled, I need always to be filling my tank. And that means reading and doing research, and then trying to see what I can make of what I've learned and how I might contribute to an ongoing conversation about whatever topic I'm pursuing, right? Yeah. That feeds and nurtures me. And so as much as I love to teach, and I really do, I also love to sit at my desk and read and write. That's how I fill my tank. And without those refill stations, it would be really difficult for me to do most of the other things I do. Okay, so.
Well, that's telling, I think, that you were made to do that work. Because not everybody would find that a relief from weariness.
Yeah. In terms of my personal shade and shadow, you know, every sermon that I preach has to do about me as well as my congregation. That's always true of us. So I find my shade and shadow in good measure in my deep faith in God and in my sense that however imperfectly, I am involved in the ministry to which God has called me. I take real sustenance and strength from that. That doesn't mean I think God is always happy about how I do things, but it does mean that that God knows that with all my perfections, I'm still trying, right? So that's part of it. I mean, my profession is also my vocation and my ministry. So that has a lot to do with it. On the human plane, I am extraordinarily blessed by my parents. My father is now deceased, but he was an enormous influence in my life. United Methodist, well, he didn't start out United Methodist, but it became the United Methodist Church, been in ordained ministry for about 70 years. And so I grew up as a preacher's kid. And that had a big influence on me. My mother, equally enormous. I have a fabulous sister. My husband and I met at Vanderbilt, and we think we have the best of both worlds because we're both biblical scholars. We understand what each other is doing, but we're not in the same field. Mm-hmm. He's in New Testament. I'm in Hebrew Bible. So we're not directly competing with each other. That works so well. After I'd been here for about 8 years, I became pregnant. By design and hope. And my husband and I have a son whose name is Joshua. He's not a biblical scholar. He's a political scientist, okay. Which ain't easy in this day and age.
Yes.
He's on the faculty at LSU in Baton Rouge, which is too far away for our taste, especially since he and his wife, Marie, have had a daughter, our granddaughter, Anne Margaret Darr.
Oh, that's fabulous.
And that's a great joy. In fact, they're coming here this weekend. A friend of theirs from college days who lives in Boston is getting married. And okay. So they're coming up to be part of that wedding.
How old is your granddaughter?
She's about 4.5 months.
Oh, wonderful.
Yes, yes. And if we were on a videotape, I'd show you a picture, but it wouldn't mean much right now. But anyway, so, a loving family, supportive family is huge in life. I was blessed with the family I was born into. But there's also the family we make. Mm-hmm. And so we all make families as we go through life. And I've been very blessed there too. Some of my dearest members of the family I've made were and are my colleagues at Boston University. I spoke with Simon Parker at the installation service. He and I were colleagues in Hebrew Bible for about a quarter of a century. And he was very important. Dana Robert, who's still on the faculty, is one of my dearest friends. She and her husband, Enos, are in Germany this semester, and I'm missing them a lot. Mm. Paul Sampley, who was one of the New Testament professors here for many years, is part of the family I've made, as well as friends from high school and college and Vanderbilt days. So sustaining loving relationships are a big part of what life is. Yeah. And beyond those things, I am happy. That doesn't mean I'm always happy about everything. My mother says joyful is a better word than happiness, because you can be joyful even when you're unhappy. So I'm going to give that one to her.
Yeah,
I think it's true. I am filled with joy. And that is genuine and not always, I can't always explain it, but it's there. It has a lot to do with my faith and my deep enthusiasm for living. Mm. So those are just part of who I am. I don't think I was so much that way when I was younger, because being very young is hard. But there are at least some benefits to getting older, and one is figuring out who you are and what's peripheral to that and what's really important to who you want to be. Not only who you are, but who you want to be.
Yeah.
So.
Well, that kind of leading into this next question, it's encouraging to hear kind of in the midst of where we're at as a country right now, and it can feel very that joy or even hope is elusive, and mm-hmm. so learning mm-hmm. how to create and enjoy a joyful life despite circumstances is, I think, something we are all striving to learn how to do.
Absolutely.
Well.
And let me be perfectly clear, I'm neither happy nor joyful about the current White House occupant. Mm-hmm. I am neither happy nor joyful about a long list of things going on in our country and in our world. That's why joy is a better word, mm-hmm. I think, than happiness, because there are so many things going on in the world that are critically troubling mm-hmm. and critically concerning for many of us. I was listening to public radio on my drive home last night, and a gentleman said, there is not a more dangerous time in our lifetimes to be alive than right now. And I thought I sincerely believe that's true. And what goes on under the current presidential administration and what's going on in the country is deeply troubling to me and can be downright depressing. And when you add to that how the current administration is trying to undermine our attempts, however small, to be good caretakers of our planet. Mm-hmm. And when I see the natural disasters and man-made and woman-made disasters that I think we're experiencing now as well, it is so grave. It is so downright depressing sometimes. And so I'm not Pollyanna. I'm mm-hmm. not living in a world that I view through rose-tinted glasses. Mm-hmm. That's not the case. So I believe that all presidential terms come to an end. Perhaps not as quickly as I might wish in this case, but they do. Mm-hmm. And so I keep myself as well informed as I can. I am in conversation. I am in prayer, and I protest a lot of what's going on in this country and elsewhere in the world as well.
Yeah, I'm glad we kind of entered into this line of dialogue, because I had a related question about thinking about seeking shade in order to be resilient in these times. And we're approaching the 1 year since the presidential election. And I remember last fall at that time, I was a first year MDiv student.
Yes.
And it was two mornings after the election. Mm. I was sitting in your intro to Hebrew Bible uh-huh. class. We were all still
in shock,
pretty shell-shocked. And you had both Democrats and Republicans in your classroom.
And I was aware that I did.
And you knew that, yeah.
Oh, sure.
And so you didn't make any kind of grand political statements, but you did take the time to pause and acknowledge that there was a deep sense of sadness and confusion and anger within how many of us were what we were feeling that morning in your classroom. But then, you know, we entered into our studies and we were trying to make the connection between what we were studying in Hebrew Bible and the tumult that we were seeing.
Yes.
And so I was wondering that given the year since then, what is your sense now for how you are helping students make connections between the study of Hebrew scriptures and the role we might play as theology students in helping to navigate the rough waters of discourse and events that we're going through as a country?
Mm-hmm. Well, I have one ready response, and then and while I'm giving it, I'm going to be thinking about some others that I might give. One thing I'm doing, I did last year as well, and that is tomorrow in class, I'm going to give the lecture on violence in the Hebrew Bible. And certainly, what I attempt to say in that lecture is as or even more relevant today than it was when I gave that lecture a year ago. Because I think that this nation is increasingly being given permission by some of its leaders to express its ugliness. And some of that ugliness takes the form of violent words. And some of that ugliness takes the form of violent actions, acts of violence against others. And violence is a considerable issue in the Hebrew Bible, and I would say a significant problem in the Hebrew Bible as well. So some of these texts that I talk about in that lecture aren't preached from very often. People tend to let them kind of slide by. Not all people. Some people gravitate toward those texts and use them to legitimate their own acts of violence. But a lot of people are content to let those texts lie. And I don't want to let those texts lie. I want to face them and learn what I can about them, and then be very sure what my response to them is. So that's one way. Not speaking about me, but I think the chapel service that I attended this morning was a wonderful example of what we're talking about, because our preacher delivered a sermon based on Psalm 137, the first four verses. By the waters of Babylon, we lay down our hearts, or hung up, or whatever we did with them. Anyway, and our preacher was talking about singing the blues, but with the blue note of hope. Mm-hmm. And so I think that one of the things that I want to do in the intro class this semester is attempt to hit something like the beautiful interplay that he gave us in our sermon about genuine blues singing, but remembering that hope is woven into the texture of the blues. Mm. Sometimes you have to listen hard for it, but it is. And so I want to do that as well. And one of the things I try often to do in all of my classes is to put different biblical texts in dialogue with each other, texts that don't sit side by side very easily, to say that, yes, there are these horribly violent texts. There are also shalom-speaking texts. They don't cancel out each other. It's not like you end up with something neutral and benign because both are there. But in order to hear what those texts have to say to us, we need to have ears attuned to each. And so that always runs like a thread through my intro class. We need to put text in dialogue, to realize the Bible doesn't speak with one voice about much of anything, right? And to do the hard work of figuring out which voices demand our greatest attention, right? So there's no lack of examples to use of violence and hatred and cruelty in our world. You know, in my lecture on violence, I talk about some conflicts that have some age on them now, but we have an example in Myanmar going on today. Mm-hmm. that is horrifying. So let's see if I can say this the way I want to. I don't surrender study of the Hebrew Bible for the sake of discussing contemporary issues. My responsibility is to teach the Hebrew Bible, but I want to do that in a way that suggests that these ancient texts have ongoing relevance, and that part of our task is to think how responsibly, given the fact that we didn't author the text in the Hebrew Bible, how responsibly we can identify their relevance, yeah. Right? So I don't look to the Hebrew Bible to tell me what I should think about sexual orientations and gender issues. I don't. Mm-hmm. And I don't look to Genesis to tell me what I should understand about how our world was created and the ways that we're putting it at risk, because that's not what the authors of Genesis were about In fact, they would not have understood what I just said in terms of their own understanding of the world that they lived in. It's not often that I say, okay, let's set the Hebrew Bible aside and talk about this. Because again, that's not what I'm supposed to do in a one semester long intro to a body of literature as vast as the Hebrew Bible. But I do want always to look at that literature with an eye to the fact that these are still living texts in many ways, and they demand our engagement. They don't always command our assent, but they demand our engagement, particularly if we're interested in careers and ministries of different types.
Yeah, and I think, I know I'm just very thankful to see it modeled in you and other professors, what that looks like to be trying to speak from a theological framework into modern times with the bravery of wrestling with the hard questions and knowing that that's not easy and it's complex, but that's what we should be doing.
That's right. The hard questions are the ones most worth wrestling with.
Yeah. We'll have two more final questions to wrap up. As you think about this future season of your life, this new role in the Beck Chair, what projects or explorations, and that could be actually either professional or personal, are you most excited about or looking forward to?
Well, I've been working on a book on Proverbs for a long time. And so I have continued to work on that. I set it aside while I was writing my sermon for the Beck installation, because writing sermons is very hard for me, right? So, but I'm back at it now, and that's a project that I'm deeply invested in, a topic that I still love, and so I'm continuing to work on that. And I know this isn't going to sound very exciting to the audience, but I'm also interested in seeing where what I'm doing now will lead me. When I look back on my life, I see a lot of serendipities. You know, things kind of come along that you aren't anticipating. That doesn't mean I don't plan or try to look ahead, but I also know that sometimes doors open where you don't expect them to open. And I'll give you an example of that just in my research. I was studying metaphor. I was very interested in metaphor, wrote a book about metaphors, female and child metaphors in the book of Isaiah. I went to an annual meeting of the Society of Biblical Literature, which meets in Boston next month. I saw a friend. I said, "What's the most interesting thing you've read recently?" She told me the name of the book. I came to our library, checked it out, read it, and that's what set me on my study of Proverbs.
Interesting.
I could never have seen it coming, but there it was, you know. And I find that if I'm open to things like that, that they present themselves more often than I might expect. So I'm looking forward to this next phase in my teaching, in my scholarly activity, in my interest in and involvement in issues that genuinely matter to me, and issues that don't genuinely matter to me yet, but they should, right? And I'm, of course, interested in the ongoing life of my family, my own family, my relatives' family, and the family I've made. And I just think it's the greatest thing in the world that every September, when the rest of the world is looking toward fall and then a long winter, in New England at least, that we have a whole new group of students that come to the School of Theology. We have a new beginning in that sense. And we also have second and third year students who've been away for a summer and have done a lot of interesting things and changed in fascinating ways. And so they're not new to the mix here, but they're different. And so I think I'm incredibly lucky to be here. As I said, not because I think it's a perfect place. When you're a preacher's kid, you grow up knowing that the church is not perfect, right? Because mm-hmm. you live with the church every day. And I don't expect academic institutions to be perfect either. I'm too old to be that naive. But I'm too United Methodist not to think that we should strive toward perfection, right?
Right.
And so I think I'm just incredibly fortunate. And now I have this new involvement with the prophet, and I'm very excited about that too.
Yeah, so we're very excited to have you.
Thank you.
Leadership
so life is good and challenging and interesting.
Great.
And that's why I'm joyful.
One closing question.
Sure.
We as students often only see kind of a small part of your life as a professor. And it's been great
to
hear.
That's a good thing.
It's been great to hear more of like the rest of your life.
Yes.
Knowing that all of you have very rich relationships and other responsibilities mm-hmm. and things beyond.
That's true of everyone.
Yes.
That's right.
So what is maybe one thing from your non-professorial life that
yes.
you'd want your students or your colleagues to know about Kathy Darr that we would not know just when we see you in the halls here at STH?
I should be careful about this. There's some things you just can't own up to, even when you're being very honest. But my husband and I watch a lot of PBS series and Netflix series. And let's see. So this summer we watched Ozarks on Netflix, and I wasn't always sure I was old enough to watch it. I'm kidding, of course, but yeah, we enjoy watching certain TV series, and we're fully capable of binge watching House of Cards when it starts a new season. So that's fun. That's yeah. relaxation for us, and we enjoy that. I really enjoy being a slob. I get dressed up and do my hair and put on makeup every day to come to school. But if I don't have to, I don't do that. Yesterday, I didn't teach, and so I pretty much look like a slob, and it was great. I was very comfortable. As long as I don't
That's
run into the president or someone.
Hilarious, because your fashion is on point in
it's
class,
okay.
for
well,
sure.
Thank you very much. When I was a graduate student, I had 3 pairs of jeans and 3 mock turtleneck sweaters, and that's what I wore every day. But yes, I have indulged that interest, and I'm one heck of a sales shopper. I've had some genuine challenges in my life, things that I've really wrestled with, including when I was quite a bit younger, real questions about my relationship with God. I was fearful. I've always been rebellious and headstrong. And I wrestled for years with the fear that if I turned my life over to God, I would lose any and all control over it. And that idea was very distressing to me. So I wrestled with that. I don't wrestle with that anymore. But that doesn't mean it wasn't a long and painful process. And I don't like it when students use technology in my classroom. It makes me really angry. And I get in trouble for that every once in a while. But I don't care. Because I think the students at the School of Theology demand respect. And part of the way students express respect for me, which I also expect to receive, is by not being on their cell phones or on Twitter or Facebook or things like that. When I'm expending a lot of effort trying to teach them. So that's something that's likely to get me to show my temper in ways I otherwise try not to show it, because I have one. That's another thing.
You have a temper.
I do have a temper, yeah. And I come by it, honestly, because my dad had a temper, too. Huh. Yeah, and he wasn't, I mean, you know, he didn't, like, haul off and hit anyone or anything. But when my dad got mad at you, you knew it, right? Yeah. And that's not something I admired about him, but I've inherited it anyway. So sometimes I walk in here and I shut the door and I put the deadbolt on and I just shout very silently. Mm. Yeah.
Mm. Thank you. No, thank you for that. Yeah, window into your life. We know y'all are all human, but...
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Very professional in class, so it's good to hear that there's Netflix and anger in your life as well.
Oh, that's of weird. Course. Because I'm a person, too. Yes. Yeah, that's right.
Well, this has been delightful. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us, Dr.
My pleasure. I enjoyed it.
I know we all appreciate the wisdom and the grace that you bring to
Thank you. I appreciate that very much. It's a privilege to be here. I know that. I never lose sight of that.
That's all we've got time for on this first historic episode of the BU Prophet podcast.
We're so thankful to Professor Dar for offering her time and her candor, to Eberly Ling for her thoughtful questions, and to you for listening.
Join us next time on the BU Prophet podcast.